Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokesman.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, part-time AquaFit participant.
And I'm Nathan Weinbender, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio.
And welcome to Movies 101, this show that loves to fantasize about, well, among other things, Hawaiian sunsets, glasses of chilled Prosecco, the look in our lover's eyes, and movies that challenge us with original ways of seeing the world. Fantasy is on the docket this week as we take a look at two films, each from distinctly different genres that indulge in fantastic thinking, though not always to the best effect. The first is F1, a Formula One racing film starring Brad Pitt and directed by Joseph Kosinski. We'll follow that with The Life of Chuck, a Mike Flanagan meditation on the nature of existence based on a Stephen King short story. Let's begin by heading into a world that has been explored before in films such as John Frankenheimer's Grand Prix and Ron Howard's Rush. And that film would be F1, or as it's also known, F1 the Movie, as if we hadn't grasped that fact following weeks and weeks of trailers. Brad Pitt stars as a long-retired, once-aspiring Formula One world champion driver who is called back to action by his friend Ruben, played by Javier Bardem, to help save the season of the racing team that Ruben owns. And, too, he's there to mentor the young, arrogant, driving phenom Joshua, played by Damson Idris. Directed by Joseph Kosinski, F1 is just what movie fans would expect from a summer movie. It's loud, a bit long at 2 hours and 35 minutes. It boasts a rousing soundtrack and racing scenes that are, in several instances, as exciting as they are far-fetched. Even harder to believe, though, is the screenplay, co-written by Kosinski and Aaron Kruger, which has Pitt wrecking more cars than he might have in a Texas demolition derby, yet still emerging as the veteran whose advice everyone should, and eventually does, follow. None of that should be surprising, though, since it's told by the same guy who directed the equally, let's beggar the facts, 2022 action flick, Top Gun Maverick.
It may seem odd that I would be the one who's starting our discussion of F1, because what do I know about F1? Well, actually, I do know a little, because...
You might know more than I do.
Yeah, okay. My cousin, Paul Truthart from Australia, actually covered F1 racing in Europe for many years. So our family did follow it a little bit. So that's my claim to fame or association or something. But that's not what this movie's about. I mean, it is about racing, but Manola Dargis in the New York Times called this a genre film. I call it another form of a cheesy sports movie, because that's exactly what it is. And that's exactly what I wanted to see in air conditioning, on the IMAX, etc. And of course, it stars, you know, some A-list actors and some newcomers. And so I thought that was a nice balance of casting. But why go see this film? For the air conditioning, and also because it does follow in those formulaic, other films about racing. But I was also thinking of Senna, which is more of a documentary film, and also Ford versus Ferrari, which we saw recently.
Which is a much better movie.
I think the focal point of the film, the racing, I really enjoyed here. The performances, yeah, I expected Brad Pitt to do a good job, because in F1, the movie, he's playing the part that we've seen him play in Ocean's 11, or even going back all the way to Thelma and Louise. And the camera does like him. I mean, at one point, these older women are sort of commenting on, you know, how hot he is and so forth. Now, that's in contrast to his young protege, who also is very hot, but no one seems to be really noticing that for reasons that I don't understand. But at any rate, I think that if we were going to talk about the movie as a movie, it's okay. If we're going to talk about this as entertainment, I was entertained throughout, and I'm just curious to find out what you guys think.
You saw it, as did I, in IMAX on a huge screen. This movie, F1, or F1 the Movie, is not a movie that you want to see on a small television set, certainly not on your laptop screen. It needs to be seen as big as possible. Otherwise, why see it at all?
And it is a summer blockbuster.
Yes,
I mean, we talked
exactly
about that recently, and yeah. I think this would fall into that category.
As was Kosinski's film, Top Gun Maverick. Same thing.
I don't know. Nathan's looking a little pained over here.
Okay. I was just trying to think about what I was going to say next. That was just my thinking face. But I was going to say that in talking about this, Mary Pat, you took one of my two log lines, which was, putting the formula in Formula One, because you know exactly where this plot is headed. You could basically map this plot out and diagram it and be pretty close to how it plays out before you even see it. But my other one would be, this is a meat and potatoes kind of movie. It's just a lot of meat and potatoes. It's like one too many courses. 2 hours and 30 minutes is a bit much for a story that is essentially extremely thin and played out. And again, in talking about F1, it's impossible not to think about Top Gun Maverick with Joseph Kosinski back in the director's chair, because it has the same basic plot and structure of that movie. And the plot and structure of Top Gun Maverick was itself borrowed from a hundred other movies, right? The difference, though, is that I don't think any of the driving scenes in F1 are as thrilling as the best of the flying sequences in Maverick. So that's one point against it. Maverick also built to what was essentially kind of a heist at the end. And so there was some suspense and there was some variation in the flying sequences there. And F1 is the movie, is basically a series of races that builds from one to the next. And they eventually kind of start to feel like they're all of a piece. And at 2.5 hours, there's some monotony there, in my opinion. Still, those race sequences are very well shot, and they're edited in
The way they were filmed.
Yeah, the way they're edited really give you the feeling of the in-the-moment knee-jerk strategy that needs to happen on the racetrack. And I thought that that was really well done. The most interesting element of the movie isn't the psychology of the drivers or the romance or anything like that. And, you know, it's basically a long commercial for Formula One. It's the how-to stuff. It's all the steps it takes to get the car on the track in the first place.
Yeah. You know, I agreed with you until last night. I was looking back, and through the algorithm on YouTube, it said, here's 9 minutes of John Frankenheimer's Grand Prix.
Sure.
And the shots there took me right in those older cars. You're right on the track, and there's a crash, and it looks fake, but it doesn't make any difference, because everything up to that, you're right in the car, right going through the streets of Monaco. And that was fascinating. And I went, you know, that's better than what we did in this modern version of F1.
Or even the Steve McQueen movie,
Le Mans.
And I think, you know, Pitt is kind of doing his McQueen routine in this. He's sort of above it all. He's kind of delivering pearls of wisdom while also inciting chaos, because he's this.
And crashing cars.
And crashing cars.
A lot
left
of
and right.
Crashing
and walking
cars.
Away like it's no big deal.
Yeah,
but yeah, no, this doesn't have the sense of claustrophobia that those earlier movies have. And I wonder if it's just because the cars are different. There's a stretch of film near the end of F1 where it's mostly, I mean, there's cuts in there, but it's mostly just a shot from basically Brad Pitt's character's point of view. Mm-hmm. And that is the most thrilling piece of film, where they kind of just, they're not complicating it too much. You're just watching the car drive through the, you know, along the track. And that's pretty cool.
Well, and in some respects, we are comparing apples and oranges, because we're talking about these racing movies that were either filmed on a track. So that's what Formula One follows, this, you know, constant, you know, track, versus Ferrari, which
it's a more
came
controlled
out
environment.
Came out last year with Adam Driver, where they were actually on a road race, and that's what made sort of it more exciting or more different, I think, in some respects. But I mean, I thought Carrie Condon was fine.
The moment she comes on screen, I went, we know where this is going.
Right. I thought Javier Bardem, you know, fine. I mean, but these weren't.
He has the biggest head in Hollywood.
That's what Dan started looking at. So you can see these were not like carved out characters that you really wanted to like learn about their inter thought processes.
No. I want to go.
And what the Kim Bonde, the Danish actor, is completely wasted in this movie.
And I want to go back to something you said at the beginning, Mary Pat, about the mix of veteran actors with up-and-comers. I mean, and of course, that reflects the plot. I really liked Damson Idris. I don't know if I've seen him in anything. He's had some TV work. I think he's more well-known in Britain. I really liked him. And then Sarah Niles, who is probably most famous for being on Ted Lasso, I really liked her as his mom. And so it had a good kind of supporting cast of people that haven't been totally overexposed yet. I was very dismayed by the Carrie Condon character, because I love her as an actor. I mean, the Banshees of Inisherin, she's so wonderful in that. And there are periods in this movie where it feels like she's playing the same role, because she's trying to break up these two guys that have this rivalry. But her character is the smartest in the room, and yet she still has to become the love interest. Totally ridiculous. Like, and I think it would have been okay if the romance between her and Pitt had, you know, illuminated their characters in some way, but it really doesn't.
Or felt natural rather than shoehorned into the story.
Yeah, it's totally ridiculous. Well, and very old-fashioned in that way.
Yes. And that's what we commented on the movie Twister, where in the end, the characters who you think are going to be love interests don't get together. So I think in some respects, that does work better. And in this case, I like the fact that she was super smart. I like the fact that she was the smartest person in the room. But then it's sort of like, oh, it devolves in some ways into something that was much more traditional.
Well, here's hoping that Carrie Condon got a really nice paycheck and we can see her in some richer roles here on out.
Yeah. At any rate, that was our discussion of the racing action film F1, the movie. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to discuss Mike Flanagan's The Life of Chuck. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed Joseph Kosinski's racing film F1. Let's now turn to something completely different, a film based on a Stephen King short story that eschews horror in favor of a story that affirms the value of a life well lived. That life is the one that intrudes on the experience of several characters that King, as adapted by the writer-director Mike Flanagan, featured in one of the stories included in King's 2020 collection, If It Bleeds. This is the third of King's works that Flanagan has adapted, the others being 2017's Gerald's Game and 2019's Doctor Sleep. Unlike most of King's plotlines, though, The Life of Chuck is a heartfelt, poignant look at a world encompassed by an accountant that few know, a man named Charles Krantz, played by Tom Hiddleston. He is the Chuck of the film's title. Told in reverse order from Chapter 3 to Chapter 1, Flanagan's film gives us three different stories, all of which get tied together, more or less, at the end or beginning, depending on your perspective. The acting is uniformly fine by the likes of Hiddleston, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Karen Gillan, and Carl Lumley, but especially by Mark Hamill as an elderly accountant and the child actor Benjamin Pajak, who plays the 11-year-old version of Chuck. Flanagan doesn't avoid some of King's trademark touches, familiar ones involving a sense of the supernatural, and weaker ones such as a character spouting cliches as if they're imparting some sort of original and clever sentiment. Yet in following one of King's most familiar themes, such as having his protagonist overcome a troubled childhood, the ultimate sense that Flanagan manages to create here is an authentic study, even given how fantastically it is conveyed, of what it means to live and to be loved.
Well, I have talked to several people that have loved this movie, The Life of Chuck, and it won the Audience Award at the Toronto International Film Festival. So, you know, it plays like gangbusters for a lot of audiences. I think the litmus test for this movie is the first of two extended dance sequences, which happens about 40 minutes in to The Life of Chuck. And if that scene doesn't make you cringe and make you want to cover your eyes like it did me, then you'll probably love this whole thing too. I think there's some lovely things in this movie, but it's a mixed bag for me. I think that first chapter, which is technically chapter three, as you've explained, I think it captures the best qualities of Stephen King as a storyteller, because it's built on this really intriguing high concept idea, but it's grounded in extremely specific domestic details and observations. And without giving too much away, it's about the end of the world, but primarily it's about these cascading events that signal the end is coming and how all these different people respond to it. And I thought it was really powerful and very intriguing. And then the movie starts to zero in on this Chuck character, who's a mystery all through that first chapter. And we realize how he's related to this apocalypse that we've watched happen. And the movie ultimately becomes about how the end of a life can also be the end of a universe, I suppose, a metaphorical universe. And unfortunately, I thought those next two segments in the life of Chuck, save for a few scenes that have kind of a malevolent supernatural edge to them, were just unbearably corny. I mean, the movie plays out to me like one of those live, laugh, love signs that you see in like the Target aisle, except that it occasionally,
put in your beach house.
Yes, but it occasionally will like drop an F-bomb and might have like a ghost in it. So it did sort of leave me cold. And I think Flanagan was really trying to make me feel something. But I agree about the performances. I mean, I think that's what kept me from outright disliking this movie. I mean, it's doing a lot of interesting things and it's very ambitious and I admire it for that. But I agree with you about Mark Hamill. It was really good to see Mia Sara, who's Sloane from Ferris Bueller's Day Off. She hasn't been in a movie in years. It was good to see her in this. And then there are also these really kind of wonderful little, basically one-act cameos from people like David Desmalchin and Matthew Lillard. And again,
he was great. They
have this specificity. And they have a task in front of them, which is reading Stephen King dialogue and making it sound like real stuff that people would say. And I think they pull it off. So kind of all over the place for me on this one. I'm really curious to know what you think about this one.
Well, of course, my view of this film, The Life of Chuck, is going to be affected by the fact that I'm a huge Tom Hiddleston fan. And so the more Tom, the better. And that's what I thought was lacking in this movie, because we see all these stills of Tom, you know, throughout for various purposes and reasons. But this is what I'm struggling with, Nathan. You talked about the dance sequence and how it was cringy. And I actually like the dance sequence, even though I'm a little bit lukewarm on the movie. So the parallel that you drew between if you like this, then you'll like the movie.
So my test was flawed, is what you're saying. Yeah, okay.
Your testing instrument or something was flawed.
Yeah, fair enough.
I did enjoy that sequence, but there was just something, I mean, it's a series of vignettes, basically, that are strung together and, as you noted, told in reverse chronological order. And I keep trying in my head to figure out, was it really necessary to tell it in reverse chronological order? And I go back and forth between yes and no, because I do think that in many respects, there were things about the first one, Act Three, that were the strongest. And so that's where I'm struggling here, not because of the conceit of doing it backwards, but when you put the strongest sequence on first, I think that's sort of a mistake, at least for viewers.
Yeah, and I'm going to take issue with both of you because I really liked this movie a lot, and it didn't bother me at all, the dance sequence, although I'm as touchy about those kinds of things as you are, Nathan. But at that point, I realized what I was watching, that it was based on a Stephen King story, you know, and he tries sometimes in really inept ways to try to touch you at the heart. But when he does, Stand By Me, it has its inept sequences, its really awkward sequences, but ultimately, it's a movie that does touch your heart.
Them's fighting words, by the way.
Yeah.
But go on.
Well, I mean, it just does. You know, I mean, I think Stephen King as a writer is a guy who's never progressed much emotionally beyond 15 years old. But beyond that, he's a terrific prose stylist, as we've talked about. But for me, this is one of the most ardent attempts by someone to take what King puts on the page and to open it up in a way that speaks about life itself. And so it worked for me, even though I understand and I get why it might not work for everyone.
And I think that Flanagan, as a writer-director, because as you mentioned, this is not his first Stephen King rodeo, I think he understands this writer in ways that a lot of directors have not been able to understand
like
him.
Like Stanley Kubrick?
Yeah, I mean, Kubrick was on his own plane altogether. But I think of someone like Rob Reiner, who adapted two Stephen King works with Stand By Me and with Misery, both of which I think are exemplary amongst the best Stephen King adaptations. And I think he got the fine line that the best Stephen King walks, which is between outright horror and complete mundane believability. And the best moments in the life of Chuck do that too. Also, I think there's another problem I have with this, which is just the style of the movie, because it kind of has this, for me at least, this weirdly off-putting, almost antiseptic quality.
Where it was clunky in a way, and that's not the right word, but I agree with you. There was something that felt, rather than authentic, it felt purposely artificial.
Yes, yes. And I think it was deliberate.
Well, yeah.
The settings and the locations don't feel lived in. It almost feels like people are in a vacuum.
It reminded me
of movies like The Truman Show or Pleasantville, which are playing around with this idea of, you know, the spooky
reality
clean 1950s.
Right,
but this one I don't think ever reconciles that.
To me, it's intentional, and it doesn't have to reconcile it because, as we find out, everything is happening in someone's mind. So
it's a single
perception of what the world is. Are these real characters? We know that they're real because at some point we see them referenced throughout each of the sequences.
Right.
But are they real in a sense that they're as real as Chuck Krantz?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I don't think it reconciles them emotionally for me in the sense that I think the style is maybe what kind of pushed me away a little bit. And also, again, I want to go back to the dancing because I love a dance number in a movie.
I know you
and
do.
When it started, I was excited. And then I thought, to just give you a little context, it's a busker that's drumming outside and Chuck stops and it becomes this full-fledged number. And I would be one of the people trying to push through the crowd and going, I have somewhere to go. Get out of my way. I would be annoyed by the whole thing. So that might win you over, or it might be the moment when you kind of start to check out. And then when there was a second dance number, it just felt like kind of Hallmarky and corny in a way that, again, King often traffics in that.
Yeah,
and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
Let's point out that the busker was the pocket queen, which is the stage name of a woman named Taylor Frank.
Yeah, and she's good. Lots of really good little supporting
characters. Well, and I also appreciated the relationship between Marty and Felicia, who were divorced, but then in the end times, they never call it the end times, the last times, they, you know, reconnect because that's what you would do, I think, is reach out to people with whom you've had a loving relationship.
Right, and I don't think we can say enough about Mark Hamill. I mean, this is a guy who started off as this, you know, half-baked actor in Star Wars all those years ago, and this guy has turned into somebody who pulls in the performance, I think, of this movie.
He's really good, and this is his first of two Stephen King adaptations this year because he's also going to be in The Long Walk, which I'm really looking forward to.
Oh.
So
yeah.
There you go.
At any rate, that was our discussion of The Life of Chuck. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbend, Murray Pat Truthart, and I discussed F1, the movie. Let's take this moment to thank Cassia Fox for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot, on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer wherever we can find it. Until then, consider these words from the late, great Albert Einstein. Imagination is everything. It is the preview of life's coming attractions. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.